Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to all of you for the invitation to this wonderful place. I've already learned a lot. I'm here till tomorrow, then I need to go back to teaching, but I look forward to talking to some of you. So this is about shining light on dark matter and dark energy with lasers and atoms. And as Holger mentioned, so I present results from two of our experiments. Many of these experiments are not based on new ideas, so I would say the new part in here is the data. And it's a bit unusual, but on the first slide, I also show you already the most basic problem in all these experiments. Why is our accuracy the accuracy it is and not 10 times better? It's because this is how a real laser beam looks like when I reduce the speed of light by a factor of a billion or so, right? It looks nearly like a plane wave, but only at the center. If you go away from the center this way, then the intensity decays. And if you go away from the center this way, then it looks more like a spherical wave. We all think that the wave number is omega over c, but that's not true. It is true with a correction factor in the center. And here the wave number can be, the wave vector can be anything, right? So k is not omega over c except for an infinite plane wave. And so all our experiments would benefit from making the laser beam thicker. The deviations from k equals omega c scale with the area of the illuminated plane in units of wavelength squared. So that's already the talk about the systematic effects. So I'll give a little bit of introduction and I'll keep it brief because you guys know much more about dark matter and dark energy than I do. I will present
we don't know anything.
Okay, but how can this be more than me? There's such a thing as inverse temperature, right? Which means you put everything in the excited state. So here's the inverse temperature about dark matter and dark energy. I'm certainly excited by it, but my knowledge might be negative. We'll see. This title is backwards. I would usually present it as, here's our project to measure the fine structure constant, and it has applications in looking for dark matter candidates. But to make it fit into the overall scheme of the talk, I'll call it searching for dark matter through measuring the fine structure constant very precisely. The next one is searching for proposed candidates of dark energy through looking for screened boson-mediated forces. What does this very long artificial word mean? Many proposals to solve the problem of what is dark energy involve new physics, and the new physics is often in the form of a new boson. It's usually a very light boson, but the problem with a very light boson is that it should generate fifth forces if it couples to normal matter. And those fifth forces should have been seen, but we haven't seen them. There are several proposed bosons with so-called screening mechanisms. They go by names of chameleons, symmetrons, Galileons, dilatons, and so on. And those might be harder to measure, so they don't necessarily contradict experiments that have already happened. And this is an experiment to try and find some of those. And the outlook is on more of these particles and how do we get the next few orders of magnitude. And I've already shown you the basic problem. To get the next few orders of magnitude, we need to learn how to make laser beams more exactly plane waves so that k is more exactly equal to omega over C. Dark matter. So this is the section on looking for the fine structure constant, finding slight deviations between the fine structure constant as determined from atom interferometry and as determined by measuring the electron's gyromagnetic anomaly. This is a project that I actually started at Stanford when I was a postdoc in the group of Steve Chu, and we are still working on it. That's more than 10 years later. So why does that take so long? There's a big difference between measuring sensitively and measuring accurately. And in this case, we need to measure accurately. What does that mean? If I'm doing a test, let's say, We all know the Michelson-Morley experiment that verifies that the speed of light is the same in all directions, right? If I get a non-zero signal at all, it is probably extremely close to zero, since we all know that special relativity works extremely well, right? So my experiment is most likely going to give an upper limit, let's say 10 to the minus 17 for variations or less. But nobody's going to care whether it's 1 times 10 to the minus 17 or 1.1, which means in experiments like that, I don't care about the scale factor, right? I needed to know only to maybe 10% accuracy. And these include experiments. Most tests of special and general relativity fall in that corner. So if I'm testing the equivalence principle, making sure that two objects fall at the same rate, then my answer is probably going to be they do fall at the same rate, or the difference is very small indeed. And in this case, the scale factor is less important. But the fine structure constant is most decidedly non-zero, and so the scale factor matters a lot. If I want to report the fine structure constant to 10 digits, I need to know the scale factor to 10 decimal places. But the scale factor in my case is given by the wave number of light, and which, as I already mentioned a few times, is not simply omega over c. There are very small corrections to it that all have to be precise to 10 decimal places. This is why these precision measurements are so hard. So at Berkeley, this was started by my great postdoc, Xiaoyu Lan, who is now assistant professor at Nanyang University in Singapore. Brian Este is a grad student. He's the guy who knew everything on that experiment, and he's unfortunately about to submit his thesis. Richard Parker has taken over from him, even in the department of knowing everything, which is great. So he graduated with Chengtian Liu at Argonne National Lab and is now the postdoc leading the project. Let me first say a few words about dark matter, and this is the part I'll keep short. So the first definite hint that there's something going on was in galactic rotation curves. We all know that. This is the velocity of a star as function of distance from the galactic center measured by Doppler shifts. And it turns out it is roughly constant as I go further and further away, in contradiction with what I would expect from Newton's law, simply because I'm further away from where the mass is, so my centripetal force is going to go down, right? But it turns out this is not so. And of course, people were looking for explanations for it. One explanation that was compatible with the data for a long time was modified Newtonian dynamics. Maybe F is not M times A, if the A is very small. This was an intriguingly simple perspective. I think it fails badly for galactic clusters, but is doing a very good job at matching rotation curves for individual galaxies. Okay? The most accepted explanation is, of course, that there's more mass than meets the eye, and this is confirmed by many observations and is now by far the most accepted hypothesis. For example, through things like gravitational lensing, I can measure how much does a light ray get bent by the galaxy. And this should be a direct measure of how much mass there is, right? And so you get these pictures that allow you to determine the mass. I can also measure how much luminous matter there is by X-ray observations. This is a relatively accurate method of measuring how much normal matter there is. And so this is the famous image of the bullet cluster, where the pink regions are the observed luminous matter, and the blue regions are the observed mass distribution from gravitational lensing. Yes, it is a false color image, but no, it is not based on simulation. It is based purely on data, okay? And the data shows that there is much more matter than luminous matter, and it's not even at the same place. So these are very strong experimental points for the fact that something is going on. It's often said that we don't know much about dark matter, but we actually know a great deal. We know how much there is, we know where it is, we know that all the known Standard Model particles have an extremely hard time being part of the dark sector. This is not zero knowledge, this is a lot of knowledge. It's just not the kind of knowledge that we look for, right? It's a particle with these and these properties. But the knowledge we already have can guide us. This is a slide from Surjit Rajendran. He's one of my colleagues at Berkeley. And he points out that dark matter can be anywhere on this enormously large range of masses. On one end, it's bounded by objects having the mass of the moon. Okay, let's call them dark asteroids. Maybe the dark matter clumps together to form objects the size of the moon, and we wouldn't have noticed. If they were even larger, then their gravitational pull would sometimes be visible in the motion of planets and stars. Okay, that's where this bound is from. The limit on the other extreme end, and I should really not mention too much about this because Surjit was a graduate student of Savas, and so there are many people in this audience that know more about this than me. I'm just going to mention what bounds it on this end is if the dark matter particles were even lighter, they could tunnel out of the galaxy, and that is in contradiction with observation, of course. The most studied region is in the middle. These are weakly interacting massive particles for which all the famous dark matter experiments produced bounds. These experiments are now reaching a level where further progress is getting harder and harder. That doesn't mean they are unimportant. They are still extremely important experiments to run. But they haven't returned a discovery yet. And so maybe we should be looking in other regions of this enormous range. Let's look for a short time into the super heavy region. And this is a paper that I wrote together with some colleagues from LIGO. The idea is if a dark asteroid zooms by, this is not a scary end of the world scenario. The dark asteroid would probably go right through the Earth and nobody would notice. But it would gravitationally pull on the LIGO mirrors and give a small blimp in the LIGO data. Now we have run a Monte Carlo simulation with various sizes of dark asteroids with various couplings. So this graph, for example, assumes only gravitational coupling. And that's a nice thing because we know for sure that dark matter interacts gravitationally. This is how it was observed. And it shows you that a dark asteroid of certain mass, ranging from 0.1 kilogram to 10 to 13 kilogram, would produce an event rate in this case, LISA, LIGO is here, of 0.1 per year. That sounds terrible. An event rate of only 1 per year is hard to measure. 0.1 per year is almost impossible. It might be shorter than the lifetime of the mission, right? Why is this nice anyway? It's because I haven't assumed anything besides gravitational interaction. So that's an interaction that we're guaranteed to have. It's also nice because at least the LIGO curves are based on actual advanced LIGO data, thanks to the great efforts of Valera Frolov. And here, if you assume an additional Yukawa coupling, well, then of course you can do anything and the event rates go up. Okay, but to the ultralight sector. Now, this is a subject where people like Surjit, Peter Graham, and also Mina have worked on a lot. And let me give you the basic idea of what happens. An X-ray photon of an energy of, let's say, 100 keV or something is detected as a particle. It goes through a Geiger counter, triggers an avalanche, and the Geiger counter goes click, right? I have here a detector for micro EV photons, and it doesn't detect them by going click. A micro EV photon is way too small to produce a noticeable effect in my cell phone. What happens instead is that 1 watt of radiation at 1 micro EV per particle means there are a lot of particles. And collectively, all these photons exert a force on the electrons in the antenna. This force is oscillating at the frequency given by the mass of the photons, right? So the idea of all these ultra-light dark sector probes is to look for tiny effects on normal matter, sometimes oscillatory, as in the case of a dark matter radio. I will have a slide on that maybe later, and sometimes constant. One case in point is the advanced cold molecule EDM experiment conducted by John Doyle, Jerry Gabriels, and Dave DeMille at Yale and Harvard. What it's doing, it's measuring, looking for an electric dipole moment of the electron, a quantity that is extremely small in the standard model. It's exactly zero if it was exactly zero if it were not for couplings of the electron to the vacuum of other particles. So small that from an experimental perspective, it's zero. The limits on the electric dipole moment of the electron that the ACME collaboration did put up, according to this graph, which I stole from Dave DeMille's homepage, and Dave DeMille tells me that it's a little outdated, the limits have moved further to the right, goes into regions where it becomes interesting for some supersymmetric theories. Okay. Another way to look for extremely light dark matter is axion experiments, right? So let's look at hertz to gigahertz frequencies over here. And one experiment is done. So the idea is the axion, collectively, lots of axions are required to make up the known dark matter density. They twist around the spins in a medium that generates a modulated magnetic field that I can pick up with a squid. And that's the idea. I'm sorry, my computer is very slow. Of the CASPER collaboration, the Cosmic Axion Spin Precision Experiment. It's a collaboration between people at Berkeley and Mainz, Stanford. I'm not sure where Mike Ledbetter is, Berkeley and Boston University. And they are looking for these tiny oscillating magnetic fields caused perhaps by axions, and are projecting a sensitivity that would go far beyond what's known from, let's say, supernova observations and so on. I will not go in detail here. I'm just giving this as examples for the kind of things people are doing in the field these days. The flavor of all these experiments, you see, this is a collaboration of 5 people and not 500 people, right? Are they guaranteed to find something? No, they are not guaranteed to find something. But given that it's a 5-person collaboration, if you have 500 scientists, you can run 100 of these experiments, right? That multiplies your chances of maybe getting something. I also want to make an intuitive argument why 5-person collaborations are sufficient for that. For decades, the paradigm in particle physics has been that the new physics is hidden because it is at very high energies. And then I have no choice but do experiments at that energy scale. The paradigm here is that the new physics is not hidden because it's very energetic. The new physics is hidden because it couples extremely weakly to normal matter. So then I need to increase the sensitivity, and something doesn't get more sensitive simply because it's large. I don't need to build a thing that produces extremely high energies. Okay, this is a graph that I can brag shamelessly about because I haven't contributed to any data point on it. It's Moore's law in atomic physics. It means that, so Moore's law is the observation that the number of transistors on a chip roughly doubles every 2 years, right? Atomic physics can lay claim to an analog of this. This is the accuracy of atomic clocks from the first cesium atomic clock by Essen and Perry in 56 to the latest clocks that are now built in Boulder, Colorado that are better than 10 to the minus 17, okay? And if I draw a line from the first data point to the last data point, I get an improvement by a factor of 2 every 2 years. And perhaps in recent years, this progress has even sped up. So if there's a dark energy or dark matter candidate that produces a very small signal here, chances are it can be picked up in the not too distant future. This is not a proof, of course. It's certainly a graph that can serve as a motivation and gives me hope that maybe the search will end up being fruitful.
Can you briefly say what's driving Moore's law in this case?
What's driving it? So there's a scientific argument and a sociological argument. The sociological argument is that all these data points are produced by 2 to 10 people collaborations, which means lots of them can work at the same time. They can figure out what the best way is to solve a problem, and then all of the 10 collaborations use that best way and make progress, right? The scientific argument is, this was Ramsey spectroscopy. Noam Ramsey got the Nobel Prize for that. It essentially allows you to use all the atoms in a hot cesium beam, which means you don't need to cool them. That was impossible to those days. They move at 1,000 meters per second, and despite the Doppler shift, they all contribute to your signal. Okay? This got better and better by controlling systematic effects very carefully, by making the clock slightly larger, and eventually by increasing the interaction time. So if I accumulate 10 billion gradients of phase shift in a second, and my signal to noise is 1,000, then my resolution is 1 in 1,000 billion, right? But if I can increase the interaction time from milliseconds to seconds, then I'm gaining a factor of 1,000. And this is what happened around from here to here, the invention of laser cooling. What happened, that was a Nobel Prize in 97 to Phillips, Quintanucci, and Chu. What happened here is going to optical frequencies. Now I'm not accumulating 10 billion gradients a second, but 10 to the 15 gradients a second. The trouble now is that I need to clockwork that can count to 10 to the 15 in 1 second. That was the Nobel Prize to John Hall and Ted Hench, the optical frequency comb generator. So that started, actually, I don't know what was the comb around in those years? No. So I'm not really sure what this is. But all those clocks made use of comb generators as the clockwork. I should also say that Ted Hench and John Hall are a very big reason that working in this field is rewarding. If you have ever met John Hall, he's the most modest, most silent, and most technically well-versed person you'll ever find. And to me, he's proof that you can get famous in a field without exaggerating your achievements, without bragging about your results all the time, while giving credits to your collaborator. He's all that. So anyway, and again, I didn't contribute to any of that, so this wasn't self-praise, okay? Here is the technology that my experiments are based on. It was invented more or less in the 90s by three people at the same time, Fritz Riele, Jürgen Blüneck, and Steve Chu. And the version of Steve Chu has become the most frequently used one. It's light pulse atom interferometry. What does light pulse mean? It means we don't diffract the matter waves at material gratings. We diffract the matter waves at standing waves of light. The advantage of that is that K equals omega over C. That means the grating constant is given by the laws of nature once I know my laser frequency. And as we've just seen, I can know my laser frequency to a precision of 15 digits. So these are very accurate instruments. And of course, as I've emphasized, K is not really omega over C, so we have systematic errors there, but they're small. So the way it works, I have an atom that was laser cooled to a velocity of maybe 1 centimeter per second on average, and then I kick it upwards in a vacuum chamber so that it's on free fall for about a second. The record is held by Mark Kasevich at Stanford. They can do it for nearly 2.5 seconds in a 10 meter tall setup. As it's on the way up, I'll fire a laser at it, and the laser will generally drive transitions in the atom. As that happens is the atom might undergo energy level changes, and it's receiving a kick from the photon momentum h bar k. The atom is now in a superposition of being here or being here, because this runs with a probability of 50%. And more laser pulses put the partial wave packets back together so that they interfere. And when they interfere, the probability of detecting the atom is given by the cosine squared of the phase difference accumulated by the matter waves while they're flying. Okay? And by phase difference, I mean the difference between the upper path and the lower path. That difference can be calculated by standard methods. It all boils down to the WKB approximation. So you integrate the Lagrangian over the path, and you add phase terms that arise from the interaction with the photons. I want to draw your attention only to the last term. It's KAT squared. So K is the wave number that determines how hard I kick the atoms. A is the acceleration of the atom. That could be from gravity, or it could be from any other forces pulling on the atom. For example, it could be due to a dark matter candidate, right? And T is the pulse separation time between the pulses. And here is data by Keng Yao Chang at Stanford. He was one of Steve Chu's grad students. This was for a decade or so the most precise atomic gravity measurement. One data point determines gravity to about a part and to about 10 parts in a billion. Okay. This has only very recently been surpassed by a group in China, which got it down to 2 or 3 parts in a billion. Okay. The limiting factor here is the vibration of the setup. Okay. Because the acceleration is measured with respect to the material setup, which is in a lab and therefore shakes. Differential accelerations, let's say if I did that with 2 species of atoms at the same time and want to know only the difference, that can potentially be done with very much higher resolution, and that's the basis for equivalence principle tests that the likes of Kasevich do at Stanford now. But in terms of sheer sensitivity to accelerations, about a part in a billion per root second is what it is. The technology hasn't stopped there. I'll highlight only a few developments that happened at places like Berkeley and Stanford. Multiphoton momentum transfer means we're kicking the atom not with one photon, but with many. And so that increases the splitting between the interferometer arms, and the interference fringes now are much finer. So this is actual data after kicking atoms with 18 photons. That was in our 2008 paper here. And you don't need to be a chi-squared expert to see how much the resolution went up compared to the usual 2-photon methods. Okay? The reason this gives me 9 squared times enhancement here is this is an experiment where the signal is not from accelerations, but from the kinetic energy of the atom, which goes like the momentum squared. Once you have an extremely high sensitivity, you're extremely sensitive to vibrations, and that can lead to a point where the individual interference fringes are invisible. I can then be lucky and run 2 atom interferometers, the lower one and the upper one here at the same time, so that they measure the same vibration, but perhaps the signal that I want to measure is different for the two. But how do I calculate the phase difference if I'm not able to fit sine waves here? I can analyze the correlations. I can plot this one on the x-axis and this one on the y-axis of a graph, and I make a parameter plot of an ellipse. The shape of the ellipse is given by the constant phase difference that I want to measure. Which data point I get is random because it depends on the vibration. But this is pulling the signal out of your noise, allows you to let the atoms fly for a longer time, and increases the sensitivity by a large factor. This is done when you want to measure gravity gradients, or here in the context of measuring the recoil energy of an atom, the energy that an atom acquires when you kick it with a photon, and that's shown here in our 2009 paper. You can run beam splitters based on optical lattices to transfer even more momentum. And this is a funny observation. It's the most important scientific result in this talk. If I run my laser pulse now and points this direction, the two atoms go in go away this way. 0.1 second, the laser beam has rotated with the Earth, and the two wave packets miss each other by a little bit. So the contrast goes down. You can compensate for that by a rotating mirror to make the laser beam non-rotating and the contrast peaks. This is important because it allows us to run larger interferometers, and it convinced us finally that the Earth is rotating. That's this most important result in the talk. Unfortunately, it's no longer new. Anyway, you can use that to measure the rest mass frequency of an atom. The recoil energy depends on the mass of an atom and the laser frequency. It results in a phase shift. You can build a feedback loop that locks the laser to that phase shift and eliminating all frequencies except the mass of the atom. And you get out a frequency that depends on your rest mass of the atom and two numerical factors that depend on the setting of a frequency comb. This is a way to measure masses of atoms based on no other fundamental constants and could be relevant in the context of defining the kilogram. It's now a quantum way of measuring the mass of atoms in absolute units. And if somebody goes ahead and defines the Planck constant, then this will become an absolute mass measurement. People plan to use another kind of instrument called the Watt balance for it that would realize the exact same definition. So this way you have two methods to make the same measurement, and then you can find out which method is more accurate, eliminate systematic errors.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What's the little n and the capital N in that formula?
Right. So what is this? As I kick the atoms acquire a kinetic energy, which would be p squared over 2m, right? And p is h bar k. So this is my kinetic energy. The phase shift is the kinetic energy over h bar times the time the atoms fly. OK. But now I'm kicking the atoms with n photons. That puts a factor of n, little n squared here. And this defines a recoil frequency, n squared omega recoil, okay, where omega recoil is h bar k squared over 2m. This frequency is on the order of 2 kilohertz. Now I multiply this by a factor of big N with the frequency comb and make this the definition of my laser frequency to a feedback loop. OK, so little n is the number of photons that I use to hit the atoms. And big N is the multiplication factor here. And now I have two equations. I have omega recoil is h bar k squared over 2m, which is h bar omega laser squared over 2mc squared. And I have omega laser is n times omega recoil. And then I solve for omega recoil, and that yields this equation. Sorry for the lengthy answer.
It's just surprising because normally you're sensitive to differential. Your claim is that you can measure the mass of an atom by that technique.
Yeah, and
usually when you compute phase shifts, you compute the differential phase shift.
Yeah, yeah, this is the
trajectories.
Yes,
and
this is
the that the rest mass component cancels because it's common to the two. It's the same atom that is going on both trajectories.
Yes, this is the phase difference between the two trajectories. That's, and unfortunately, of so what would be, let's say, in in a fairy tale lab, we would love to measure this frequency, right? And then we would be accumulating 10 to 26 radians a second. But that term cancels out, right? What does not cancel out is the tiny difference between the two paths that arise because the kinetic energy, right? So the rest mass energy of this cancels out. Okay. Only the kinetic energy remains.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. I mean, anything else would be strange.
The momentum dependent terms don't cancel.
The momentum dependent terms don't cancel. That's exactly right. But they are related to the mass, of course, and so I can extract the mass by this locking trick.
Right. So little n is a measure of the momentum that is imparted by the photons on the atom.
Exactly. So if I run this with, let's say, the data in this paper was run with little n equals 5, that means we're kicking the atoms with 2 times 5 photons, and big N about 3 billion, so that this frequency turns out to be kilohertz, while of course this term is something like 10 to 25 a second or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And capital N again was a hundred.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Capital N is...
So the experiment measures these 2 kilohertz directly, and then multiplies it by harmonic generation with a factor big N. So I take the 2 kilohertz from the interferometer, I actually n squared times 2 kilohertz, which turns out to be roughly 100 kilohertz. I multiply it to 3 to 10 to the 14 hertz so that it can serve as a reference for the laser frequency. And that's the number big N. So that's, again, the femtosecond frequency comb generator that allows us to generate this extremely high harmonic. Yeah, so this is how this works. This is not revolutionary in any way, right? It's still, yeah?
Sorry, how do you compare the frequency? Because this N factor, is it coming from the laser? How do you take that kilohertz frequency? Do you actually turn it into, how do you compare the two signals? Because even for a frequency comb, the carrier frequency is usually at the optical, right? And
right.
It's divided by... very small increments.
Right. So,
so this big N factor is I think, what needs to be
the. So the way it works is I'm starting with roughly 100 kilohertz.
Yeah.
This goes into an electronic box that multiplies it by 2,000, which is then 200 megahertz. I hope I'm getting these numbers right. That's the rep rate of my frequency comb. So this is the frequency comb. It produces a train of optical pulses, 200 million of them per second.
So you're turning that,
So this is time, this is electric field, right? And in the Fourier transform, where this is frequency, this looks like lots of lines that all satisfy, let's say, the frequency of the nth line is a number n times the repetition rate plus an offset, and the offset, there's a way to lock that to zero. And this would be the repetition rate. So what we do is we first multiply it into the hundreds of megahertz, which can be done by an electronic thing. And then it's a laser that has this repetition rate and produces lots of Fourier harmonics. And this is not at all trivial. This was the Nobel Prize to Ted Hensch and John Hall, right? So we borrowed that technology from them. It's in fact a commercial box that you can now buy. Then we need to pick out one of these lines, for example, this one, and compare it to our laser frequency. But this is a standard method. In fact, it turned out the first application of that was we thought we were a few lines off because our wave meter was badly calibrated. Anyway, so this is how it works. Yeah.
I'm confused about why are you still in this number. Where does your accuracy coming from in measuring this 100 kilohertz? Because it looks like now I'm just confused.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like by putting it into electronics and then fitting it, you're introducing systematics. So you're losing the fact that you were using a very accurate clock in the beginning for this 100 kilohertz. It has been masked by electronics. So
oh, no, this is just generating harmonics. This doesn't produce errors. The main the main error is that here I've assumed that K is omega over C,
mm-hmm.
and that's the thing that is only roughly true, which I already mentioned, and I'll have more details on that. But this translation from K into omega over C introduces a part per billion error. And in the talk, I will tell you how we reduce it to a tenth of a part per billion.
Okay.
But that's the main error. In fact, this is probably the worst clock that was talked about at a physics meeting in the past couple of years. It's not an accurate clock. It's a clock relating time to the mass of a particle. It uses a different kind of reference. But as a clock itself, it is not at all competitive with atomic clocks of the usual kind.
Okay.
All right. My computer went to sleep. The fine structure constant, and I will have to speed up a little bit because I'm already talking for 45 minutes. So the fine structure constant is, of course, characterizing the strength of the electromagnetic interaction. As such, it can be measured in many ways. And the most accurate ways are either measurements of H over M. And you can already see that this is sensitive to H over M. Because if you say, I know T, I can measure that with a clock. I know K, then this is a measure of H over M, the ratio of the Planck constant to the mass of an atom. R comes from measurements of the electron's gyromagnetic ratio. And the best of these measurements is by Jerry Gabriels in Harvard at 2008. I met him yesterday, and he tells me he's working on the next factor of 10, but he isn't close yet. These are his words, not mine. We are also working on the next factor of 10, and I leave it to you to judge how close we are. Okay, why is that interesting? Well, the way it works is this equation. Both sides of the equation are the ground state energy of hydrogen, written as the Rydberg constant times H bar C in one case, or as m electron C squared times alpha squared in the other case. Okay? You can now solve that for alpha squared, and then you have alpha squared is the Rydberg constant times H bar over C over m electron. So if I know H bar over m atom, and I know the electron over atom mass ratio, then I can make this calculation and get alpha. Then I can use the standard model to calculate G minus 2. And the purpose of this graph is just to show what a complicated calculation that is. It involves over 10,000 Feynman diagrams. And you need to know about muons and hadrons to get it right. So large parts of the standard model have to be correct in order for this number to work out. Unfortunately, it's only this number that's known to 0.24 parts per billion these days. So we're trying to improve this side of the equation to turn this into a test of the standard model. I already explained how it works. So these types of interferometers are sensitive to H over M. So I'll skip over that. We want more signal than here. So we introduced Bloch oscillations. That's a coherent way of accelerating matter waves by simply putting them in a periodic potential, which you then accelerate. Put them here. That increased the momentum transferred to the atoms to 310 photons. As far as I know, that's the largest ever demonstrated. And helps us a lot because these measurements measure the kinetic energy. So we gain faster than the photon number increases. Here's an idea that we borrowed from the Kasevich group. That's again an example how people in this field adopt each other's methods quickly. It's a way to enhance the contrast of these ellipses by compensating for a systematic error. But now, of course, what about, by compensating for random forces on the atoms that arise from laser beam imperfections. Anyway, but now systematic errors. This is a graph of the fine structure constant as function of how long our atoms fly. And obviously, this graph should be flat, right? It's not flat. The linear trend we do understand. It comes from the Schrödinger equation of the light-atom interactions. But you see, it's not strictly linear. We track that to the atoms moving relative to the laser beam, which we eliminated by selecting out only the atoms at the center, which made this agreement between theory and experiment much better. But if you look very closely, there's a tiny deviation here. And that's too much for precision measurement of alpha. It's blown up here as of July 2016. It deviates by several parts per billion. And we think we found out what's going on. It has to do with the non-Gaussian shape of laser beams. I will not bother you with the details. I will bother you with the information that this is the result of several years of work that, and I'm very proud that my postdocs and grad students figured that out. If it were not for the requirement of measuring at absolute accuracy, this project would have been done many years ago, right? Okay, with this eliminated, we can now see what it means, and there's a known deviation of the muon germagnetic ratio. Which, if you would scale it, would lead us to expect a small deviation in the electron, if this is real and not an artifact, which it might very well be, right? It's a 3-4 sigma effect. These effects come and go. Here is an idea that Sujit has worked on, I think, and this is my summary of all the data. Maybe this deviation is due to a so-called dark photon, which is essentially a heavy brother of the photon. Here's its mass from 1 MeV to 1,000 MeV. And here's its coupling strength. If the coupling strength were 1, this would look like a photon. If it's very small, then it couples weakly. These limits here come from particle accelerator experiments, very many of them, SLAC, CERN, DESY. These come from beam dump analysis. So you let the LHC beam run into a beam dump and analyze what comes out. This is supernova 1987. The green band would explain the muon anomaly. The current limits of alpha versus electron G minus 2 rule out this large area. So even the old data rules out a large area on the plot. At our current accuracy, we can rule out a little better. For reference, there was a claim that there's an anomaly in beryllium 8 decay at 17.7 MeV, right? This would be here. So it's not ruled out by the old data. It is ruled out by the new data. And maybe in 10 years, if we can convince the funding agencies to make it happen, we can cover this region. And that's what this has to do with dark matter. So dark photons of this energy can't be dark matter in itself. They can be a messenger connecting to the dark sector. All right, and I have only a few minutes to present what we did about dark energy. So here's, of course, the evidence from the Supernova Cosmology Project. I will not go in details because you know it better than I do, but I will say that before Sal Perlmutter and Rich Müller and so on started working on this, the data looked like this and was perfectly compatible with a universe without dark matter, without dark energy. They managed to measure an order of magnitude better, and the discrepancy becomes significant. So if you are able to measure something one order of magnitude better, great things can happen. The dark energy density is pressed in units of meters. It's unimaginably small, 1/1 the size of the universe. But as an energy density, it's more easily to imagine. It's the energy of 7 hydrogen atoms per cubic meter, or an electric field of 14 volts per meter. Or you can ask the following. I divide space into little boxes of length L, and into each box I put one photon of wavelength L. What L do I need to get the dark energy density? It's about 100 micron. All these scales make it sound more humanly possible. This is the slide where I emphasized that we don't know much, Pauli already realized that vacuum fluctuations would blow up. And in fact, most straightforward way to explain dark energy would be as vacuum fluctuations. But then you're 123 orders of magnitude off. This has improved since the days of Pauli by a factor of 2, because Pauli didn't know that the energy of a ground state harmonic oscillator is 1/2 h bar omega. OK. If you invoke supersymmetry, the main divergences cancel out, but then you're still left with this term, which my friend Justin Curry tells me does not cancel out. So you need new physics to explain it. That typically involves new bosons. They should somehow couple to normal matter, at least with gravitational strength. So where are they? We know, of course, from torsion balances and solar system tests that there are no fifth forces of gravitational strength unless you go to very short distances. But in this region, they're ruled out. Okay. So what could be the case? Well, and this is an idea of some people, including Justin, the dark energy boson might behave in a strange way so that its interactions are suppressed for macroscopic objects. And the way this works is, in this particular chameleon model, but I don't want to advertise it too much, the mass of the particle depends on the mass density of the environment, because it has a potential that's going down and flattens out like this. And if you add the interaction term, you get an effective potential that has a minimum here that would determine the field strength in vacuum or in this environment. And the second derivative of this would determine the mass. If I now make the same plot with a lot of normal matter surrounding it, I would get a strong curvature here and therefore a higher mass. And the consequence of all this would be, the consequence of all this would be that as soon as I go into a high density environment, the particle becomes extremely massive, therefore extremely short range, and essentially decouples. This is not even a consistent theory. Okay, it is not consistent because the chameleon, as simple as I presented it, is strongly coupled. And that means essentially we don't know how to predict its behavior. Okay? But I want to make an analogy to these gentlemen. This is Faraday, who found out how to study magnetism and came up with Faraday's law, which by itself is not comprehensive. It doesn't describe electromagnetism even in a self-consistent way, right? But it was falsifiable. And he tried to falsify it, failed many times. That gave us confidence in this. And then later, this gentleman made it part of the Maxwell equations, putting together incomplete theories to make one comprehensive theory. And 30 years later, that was fully verified. So it was 60 years from incomplete but falsifiable theories of electromagnetism to a full theory which was experimentally verified. And maybe our understanding of the dark sector is somewhere here. So we need to find something like Faraday's laws of the dark sector. We need to make inroads by looking at incomplete models that are not predictive or predictive in some corner, but not necessarily comprehensive. And that's how I view this field. So the idea is I'm looking for interactions between two normal matter objects of roughly gravitational strength. But as soon as this chameleon field enters my object, it decouples. So it couples only to the outer skin of my cell phone and my hockey stick. And while the gravitational pull between these two is measurable, the gravitational pull between their two outermost nanometer skins is not measurable. That's the idea. Now, of course, there are ideas by these people, Claire Burridge at Copeland and at Heinz, how you can measure it anyway. And the idea is you replace one massive object by an atom. And the outermost layer of the atom is the entire atom. So you're rid of one of the suppression factors. I'm sorry, I'm going very fast. Yeah,
sorry. But if the theory is strongly coupled, you don't have any control over this.
I'm not saying that the theory is not useful in the low energy region where I want to use it. It is certainly not useful at high energies.
No, but it may be problematic even at low energies, meaning that if the scale n there, the atmosphere assuming is much smaller than a Planck, then the expansion of the carbon that you have phi over n times rho could not be, may not be valid. Or adiabatic corrections are not under control.
This is correct. I'm so looking.
So maybe even the form of the potential changes for the field. This
yes.
is the statement that it's in part strongly coupled.
Yes. What I'm looking for is a, so I'm not working on this myself.
No,
what I'm treating, what I'm treating this is take whatever high energy theory, and I'm calling it a chameleon so long as it has this low energy behavior. If such a theory doesn't exist, then this work, then there is no chameleon to look for, right? What Claire Burridge is doing these days is she's looking at UV complete versions of that. She hasn't shared the details with me, but there's at least in the, let me come back to that on another plot. But the idea here is I'm not saying that this is a satisfactory theory of energy. I'm just saying maybe there is a theory which has this at the low energy limit, and that's what we would be testing. How to connect that to the fundamental high energy theory is another matter. Anyway, so we were building an experiment to look for a gravitational Harnoff-Bohm effect. I'm going to skip this. And then we found the Claire Burridge paper telling us we can use that to look for chameleons. And so here's our setup. This is the test mass, and I'm looking for forces between the atoms and the test mass. And I'm sorry, I have to click through this very fast. Essentially, the red dots are data with the sphere nearby, and the blue dots are with the sphere far away. You see no obvious difference between them, and the data, after some systematic corrections, constrains it to roughly a micron per second squared, which rules out this region. It doesn't really close. The nice thing about this model is that it is falsifiable in the sense if the coupling parameter is in this region, it contradicts macroscopic experiments. If it's in that region, it contradicts us and the neutron guys and so on. So if you can close all this white space, then the theory, even in this lenient version where you don't worry about the divergences, is ruled out. Okay. We can compare ourselves to the CERN people that look for photon coupling. So there we are. And we can put it in the context of collider experiments. I'm going to be real quick here because I want to show you some outlook. So we have made the experiment better, colder atoms, more atoms, an optimized geometry, vibration isolation, and so on. The data now has a much higher signal to noise. This is new. This is old. We can run this for a couple of hours. Now it measures interactions of gravitational strength. We can now see the gravity between the atom and the object. And that's the region where it should get interesting because of these arguments that those interactions should at least have gravitational strength. Of course, these are not precise arguments, but it's at least moving into the direction where it's getting interesting. Enabling technologies. We need lasers that allow us to make this beam bigger so that K is more accurately equal to omega over C, and these lasers exist. You need to make the beam thicker to have a lot of power. There are general models of screen scalars. So a scalar can either be screened by having a fancy potential that would lead to chameleons. It can be screened by having a strange coupling to normal matter that would lead to symmetrons and dilatons, and there's a Damour-Polyakov mechanism. Or it can be screened by having a strange kinetic term that would lead to so-called Galileons, which I hear are appealing from a theoretical point of view. Experiments like that can put new limits on symmetrons and the Damour-Polyakov particles. I don't have time to explain this, but this is a back of an envelope graph that shows that we can do better by several orders of magnitude here. Oh, that's the new one, sorry. This we already did. Galileans are complicated, but I started working with Justin. You can get limits from lunar laser ranging. This would be the coupling parameter to the third order term. This is the fourth order term. Lunar laser ranging puts it in this corner, so the blue area is allowed. You can measure the moon's orbit as the Earth goes closer and further away from the sun. So if there's any Galilean-mediated interaction between the moon and the Earth, this should lead to the moon moving closer and further away from the Earth. Yeah, Mina.
But this theory still has a Turing problem because the coupling to the thin mu breaks the Galilean symmetry. So
yeah, but it is very small. It is assumed to be gravitational.
Even if it's gravitational strength, if you calculate radiative corrections, it's huge, right?
Yeah, but you see, this is not really my problem to worry about.
but then I don't understand if we're testing theories that are not self-consistent, then...
Well, by these arguments, the Higgs is way too light, right?
Yeah, but this may be even worse. Yes, I agree if it's just one coupling, but then there could be other things that depend on the form of phi. Could be one tuning, but in many cases, in these cases, you have many tunings, because when you write a specific function, in many cases in these theories, many of the terms have to be tuned. I agree, for the Higgs it's a problem, and you worry about it. But, yeah, but this is something to keep in mind, right?
Right. The thing is that there's no theory of dark energy that has no problem. And figuring out one is your job, and testing the ones that are there already now is my job.
This is true. But as a rule, none of these theories solve the dark energy problem.
Right.
In reality, right? So, yes, you can try to say, do I test the theory that has a light particle interact this way, but they don't solve the dark energy problem.
The dark energy problem as defined, and why does it have this particular density?
No,
which problem do you mean?
The fact that it's 123 orders of magnitude above where
right.
It should be. These theories have no bearing on explaining that fine-tuning problem.
Right. I'm not saying that I have solved the fine-tuning problem, right? I'm just saying that these are theories that people have proposed, and my experiment can say something about them. Do they solve the cosmologic constant problem? It would be great if they did. In absence of such a theory, it is important to test the theories that are nevertheless out there. Once there is a theory that would solve the cosmological constant problem, I think there will be no problem finding people who want to test that theory, right? And I mean, as an experimentalist, I don't really care so much about that. Given that.
I wasn't worried about these labels right now, because I agree you can try to look for the.
Oh, you worry about this headline. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, well, we are worried about your abstract.
What is the abstract?
The abstract says that you're talking about dark energy models, and it suggests that these theories actually address a fundamental question about the smallness of the dark energy. And what we are telling you is that they have nothing to do with that, with the true cosmological constant problem. They have nothing to do with the dark energy problem.
I
say this is my Lagrangian, and I'm testing this the presence of this particle phi. And
but this is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, that's all you're saying, in fact, but the label that it's related to the dark energy problem is misleading.
Let me make two answers to that. If we agree that this is what I'm talking about, then we shouldn't be arguing about the words. And
the words come.
The other thing.
I must say, when I read your abstract, I got very excited. So I said, I shouldn't miss this talk.
So now you're very disappointed. I'm sorry for bringing you here.
No, I'm impressed about the things that are your job, namely to do a great experiment. That's very impressive. All I'm telling you as a theorist is that I don't think this is related to the dark energy problem.
Let's put it this way. It's important for an experimentalist to listen to many theorists, and the theorists that are working on these models say that has anything to do with dark energy. So what it means probably is we're looking at possibilities for overlooked bosons. And why are people thinking about these bosons? They are in part motivated by dark energy. Of course, what I'm doing in the lab, I'm not taking the intergalactic space and do experiments with it, right? In that sense, anybody who says they are testing dark energy in any way is either looking up in the sky or is taking a theory out of context. This, even a theorist who says this is a dark energy model would say, okay, this is something I've set up to explain what happens in the intergalactic space, and using it in the lab involves an extrapolation by many, many orders of magnitude, mm-hmm. right? In that sense, this extrapolation is a fact that bothers me much more than the fact that a Galilean theory and so on might not be completely satisfactory. Because I'm okay with a theory that works in one regime, even if you don't know how to make it work in all regimes. But then you still have this extrapolation problem, which is the case in any theory that you take from the cosmos into the lab. That's the fact that I'm much more worried about. Anyway, so Galilean limits. So the idea is, if you go close to a big object such as the sun, the Galilean field no longer behaves like a Galilean in vacuum, but you get renormalized terms. They depend then on the distance to the sun, and that modulates forces. This is a limit you would get if you measure Galilean-mediated forces in an atom interferometer and look for a yearly periodic signal that modulated with the distance from the sun. This is, if you do the same experiment under slightly optimistic assumptions. This is if you transfer it on the ISS and measure it there and use the Earth as the object that does your renormalization, but you see it doesn't really have an advantage. And this is measuring the acceleration of force of an atom relative to the ground. This is actual data, obviously not at the sensitivity we need. And look for modulation in there. All right, you can do it in space. As a summary, these are limits that we obtained on chameleons. You can see that with a very weak coupling, it's ruled out by the Edwish collaboration. With very, very strong couplings, you can use smaller and smaller systems to test it. So from this range, you limit it by colliders first, then neutron interferometry, then atom interferometry. And our data by now has moved this limit from here to roughly there. So there's still an order of magnitude to go. And if you did that, then all this space would be filled. Measuring the fine structure constant more accurately is interesting from many respects. This is in context of a dark photon search comparing to other accelerator models. But I should say it's really interesting in a much broader context, because any new physics that somehow couples to electrons would shift the electron g-2 around. And in order to do so, it doesn't need to break a fundamental symmetry. So that's a fundamental advantage of measurements like this over, let's say, EDM measurements, where you have to break a fundamental symmetry before you get a signal. OK, and with that, I would like to thank the collaborators and the funding agency. So here's Justin Curry, who has helped us with the chameleon stuff. It's Paul Hamilton, who has done that experiment, and the funding people. Sorry for going over time, and thanks so much for listening.
Let's first include a question from Psi students. And PhD students. All right, Mina.
She's an ex-student.
All right, so let's open for questions.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
When you were talking about using the atom as a clock, the mass of the atom as a clock, so you're saying that you're dominated by laser systematics. Let's say if you were to go crazy with that, how well would you say that I can use the mass of the atom as a clock? Would it be comparable eventually to regular clocks? Can you even do better than?
If I go totally crazy, like science fiction crazy, then.
No, let's say, not Star Trek crazy, but let's say more.
No, let's.
I don't know, let's say in the next 10, 20 years, then it's here.
Let's give both crazy. So, science fiction crazy, the answer is yes, because many things shift atomic energy levels around, such as magnetic fields, but it takes a tremendous magnetic field to change the mass of a nucleus, right? So, at the science fiction level, yeah. What would you need to do for that? Well, if I can get this factor to the level of one, that means if I had an X-ray laser, then this would get extremely good. On the practical level, the answer is very clearly no. We have worked a lot to get this to subpart per billion accuracy, while the regular atomic clocks are already much better. In a sense, this is at the accuracy of Essen and Perry in 56 now. So this is not an efficient way to make a better clock. It is simply a new kind of clock.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Holger Moore again.
Thank you.